From Washington, D.C., across the nation and around the world, stand by for an overview of the hottest topics and people being discussed on air, online, at the coffee shop and across the backyard fence, powered by the research of Talkers Magazine, The National Conversation. It's time for the Michael Harrison Wrap. Here's Michael Harrison.
Thank you, Victoria Jones. Monday, February 21st through Friday, February 25th, 2022. It was a week that started with President's Day, celebrating our nation's historic commanders-in-chief, and ending with a battle of nerves and dollars between the contemporary presidents of the United States and Russia, with the president of China throwing in his two remembe as well. We're about to embark upon a powerful hour of Black Belt Talk Radio, during which your tolerance for hearing different but legitimate points of view, especially about the war in Europe, will be tested. We've got lefties, we've got righties, we've got fence sitters. Please don't get angry. Just listen closely, and while doing so, maintain a degree of educated skepticism, regardless of whether or not you agree. We'll be joined by Kevin Casey at the Talkers Communication Center in snowy New England with the top 10 topics of the week. Victoria Jones in Washington, D.C. with an insider's view of the political class's reaction to the war. Frank Morano in New York City discussing an interview he conducted with an American expat communist sympathizer fighting for the Russians in Ukraine. Whoa. Dr. Dahlia Wax in Las Vegas with the latest pandemic poop. Ross Kaminsky in Denver with his educated take on the impact the Russia-Ukraine crisis might have on the already troubled American economy, especially at the gas pump. And media law professor Matthew B. Harrison in Springfield, Massachusetts, on the details surrounding Donald Trump's newly launched social media platform, Truth Social, designed to compete head-to-head with Twitter. An impressive array of influential yappers from across the country with microphones, smartphones, and digital recording devices sharing their observations and the feelings of their target constituents, with whom they do a daily dance of affirmation in a fragmented, noisy world where we try to avoid the modern-day syndrome of seeking victory at the expense of truth. Welcome to the Michael Harrison Wrap, heard coast to coast and around the world on great radio stations across the U.S. and the U.K. The past week's hottest political and social topics discussed in the American talk media. Information's gathered from a variety of sources, including data tracked by the broadcasting trade publication Talkers Magazine, of which I'm editor and publisher. This installment of the Michael Harrison Wrap is being brought to you in part by Bernadette Duncan's book that takes the reader into the world of talk radio. It's titled Yappy Days, Behind the Scenes with Newsers, Schmoozers, Boozers, and Losers. It's available now at Amazon.com. Okay, here we go. Joining us now is Kevin Casey, executive editor of Talkers Magazine. Kevin, give us a rundown of the 10 most talked about stories on talk shows in America this past week.
Thank you, Michael. At number 10 this week, winter weather tied with climate change. Even though the official start of spring is only a month away, much of the eastern portion of the nation was hit by freezing temperatures, ice, sleet, and heavy snowfall.
And in the West, the drought continues. Meantime, the ongoing conversation about the weather always includes concern about climate change, some of which is scientifically valid and some of which is conveniently political.
At number 9, U.S.-China relations. While hostilities are flaring along the border between Russia and Ukraine, Chinese warplanes have been ominously encroaching on Taiwan airspace.
No doubt Xi Jinping is inspired by the military adventures of his buddy Vladimir Putin.
At number 8, social media tied with the launch of Donald Trump's Truth Social platform. Just like the weather, social media is always in the national conversation in terms of privacy invasion, political bias, and journalistic integrity.
And so is Donald Trump. His new social media app called Truth Social debuted this week with a huge waiting list of Trump fans signing up as the fledgling platform works out bugs in its system.
At number 7, crime and violence tied with race relations. The troubling statistics on crime and homelessness in our nation's cities continues to spike.
And on the racial front, A jury in Georgia found the three white men who killed Ahmaud Arbery guilty on all counts in the federal hate crimes trial. The defendants are already serving life sentences in prison after being convicted of murder in state court last year. And more legal action took place this week in the George Floyd case, as three former Minneapolis police officers were found guilty of violating the high-profile murder victim's civil rights by a federal jury in St. Paul.
At number six, the Supreme Court nomination process. Word in Washington is that President Biden has narrowed his potential choices from three down to one.
And at the time we're putting the final touches on this program Friday morning, sources report that the president has made his choice, an African-American woman as promised, Ketanji Brown Jackson.
At number five, the 2022 and 2024 elections. Welcome to the era of nonstop election jockeying. Not only are the races for the forthcoming midterm elections heating up as the Republicans look to retake a workable majority in both houses of Congress, but speculation abounds about how things are shaping up for 2024's presidential sweepstakes.
And the ringmaster most mentioned in this circus, either as a kingmaker or candidate, is Donald J. Trump.
At number four, the January 6th committee. And the beat goes on as America comes to grips with the causes and ramifications of the violent attack on the Capitol more than 1 year ago.
More than 20 potential witnesses have sought to block the committee's pursuit of phone records by challenging the House's subpoena power in court. Two names being discussed as witnesses that could cause Trump headaches are his daughter, Ivanka Trump, and former attorney, Rudy Giuliani.
At number three, COVID-19. The conversation and debates continue over vaccines, mandates, masks, and variants.
And the trucker convoy that rocked Canada is now being emulated by a national freedom convoy in the United States that's protesting more than just COVID mandates.
At number two, the economy, the nagging issues of inflation, supply chain breakdowns, and the great resignation continue to weigh on Americans.
Intensified by fears of what economic sanctions against Russia and the war breaking out in Europe will have on the price of oil and the cost of filling up at the gas pumps.
And at number one this week, the Russian invasion of Ukraine. This is the big one, folks. The Russian invasion of Ukraine, including speculation over its dangerous ramifications should it escalate, has been the dominant subject of conversation on the talk shows of America this past week.
The world has become an extremely dangerous place as Vladimir Putin takes a page out of the dark playbook of some of history's most vicious autocrats and authoritarian troublemakers. Thank you, Kevin Casey from Talkers Magazine. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. The Russian invasion of its neighbor and former Soviet satellite Ukraine has rocketed up to the top of the Talkers chart this week. To get a perspective from the nation's capital, we're joined now by our Washington correspondent, the executive director of the D.C. radio company, Victoria Jones. You know, Victoria, it amazes me how one story can sort of sneak up on all the others, go to the top of the survey as the Russia-Ukraine war has this week, and then change the nature of what we consider to be the priorities in terms of the national conversation. You know, COVID is number three this week. Russia's number one, and the economy is number two because it ties in so closely to the Russia situation. And that makes this passing parade of current events a fascinating and certainly difficult thing to predict, but it's a fascinating thing how we change our priorities.
I would say it is fascinating, and the nature of the conversation is inevitably going to change because we're only able to stay focused on something for so long, and the economy is really interesting because the Biden administration, the European Union, all kinds of entities are putting tough sanctions on Russia, and those sanctions are going to bite, and they're going to affect oil prices here in the United States. And the Biden administration is starting to try to get people ready for an increase in the price of gas, and people are not going to like it.
And Biden has also, or the U.S. government really, has warned everybody about this pending military action in a very direct manner. I have heard that the people in Russia have thought of the American information, the Americans' warning that there's a military buildup and that Russia is going to invade the Ukraine, as American propaganda. That the average Russian did not necessarily
believe it. Of course, you know, the government controls the media there, and it's hard to control the media completely in this day and age. But now the Russians are seeing that, wow, the Americans were telling the truth. We are at war. And I would imagine, I don't speak as an expert on Russia, but I would imagine that just as in this country, there are many different points of view about Putin's military adventurism.
Yes, I think there are. I think differing points of view with Putin are kept fairly quiet these days because you could wind up in prison on so-called corruption charges, like his main opposition leader, Alexei Navalny, who is facing another 15 years, and there was an attempted poisoning attempt, at least one, on him. But people do have different views from Putin. And if and when Russian soldiers start to come home dead, there will be concern. Alexei Navalny this week was warning in a series of tweets and in court during his trial of what was likely to happen. And he's comparing this war that Putin has launched with the Afghanistan war that Russia launched.
Yeah, it's very hard these days to just simply go in and occupy a nation that has resolve, that has a different type of geography, and that has some type of military capability and support from other countries. So, as Mike Tyson said, and I saw this thrown around in the media as Mike Tyson giving Putin advice, Mike Tyson has a saying, and I'm paraphrasing it, that you can go into a fight with a game plan, you know, totally prepared, and your game plan goes out the window the first time you get punched in the mouth. That's the end of your game plan. And these wars that big nations tend to go into don't always work out as well as their governments or their leaders assure the people that they will. You know, shock and awe, you know, mission accomplished. Afghanistan, of course, turned out to be a debacle for both Russia and for the United States at different times, as did Vietnam. Just having military might doesn't guarantee, you know, an easy takeover of another nation. There are also differing points of view being expressed about this on talk media shows around the country, even though it is predominantly anti-Putin and supportive of basically the U.S. position on this. There are a number of people on the air that in conservative circles, interestingly enough, which one would not have expected based on past divisions in terms of left and right. But today, left and right are not quite the same as they used to be. So there are people on the right who are, I guess the word is sympathetic to the Russian position and saying we're missing the picture. And I find that fascinating as well.
We're hearing it for a number of different reasons, some because they like his might. And there's a feeling that might is to be admired for whatever reason. Some saying, look, we should be focusing on our own borders. And some would say that's a legitimate reason. But many, certainly politicians in Washington, D.C., where I am, Arkansas governor, well, he's in Arkansas, but Governor Asa Hutchinson is saying that this is an invasion of a sovereign nation. Mitt Romney, the senator who has previously praised Putin, is now calling him a tyrant. So people now seeing what is going on the conservative side are not so happy about this at all. Marsha Blackburn in Tennessee, she has been extremely strong and is calling for Russia to be removed from the international banking system.
I'm going to be having an interview with Frank Morano from WABC on this program earlier this week. He interviewed a communist freedom fighter, an American expat who's been living in Ukraine for the last 8 years fighting the Ukrainians on behalf of the Russians. And he's getting all kinds of blowback. It's interesting how this works. Now, what's the attitude in Washington. It goes back to what we talked about earlier. You know, people have been talking about the economy and COVID and the truckers and the elections and January 6th committee and the Supreme Court nomination and, you know, so many issues there. Right now, I'm sure that the Russia-Ukraine war dominates the conversation among the political class in D.C.
Oh, it does. And everybody's an expert now. Yeah, everybody's read three articles somewhere and become an expert in the geography and in the history of the whole of all of it. So everybody knows everything, which is so interesting. But what's also been fascinating this week is that the House and the Senate have both been on recess, which means the politicians have been mostly in their home districts and out of the action, leaving all the action to the White House, which is enormously frustrating for them. Their staffers have been in D.C. So they want to get back to D.C. next week and start passing legislation tougher than the White House, partly because some of them believe it, but also to show anything he can do, we can do better.
That's our Washington correspondent and executive director of the D.C. radio company, Victoria Jones. Coming up next, a visit with Frank Morano at WABC New York. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. Bernadette Duncan spent 26 years as a radio talk show producer. In her new book, Yappy Days, Behind the Scenes with Newsers, Schmoozers, Boozers, and Losers, she shares her adventures in the trenches of big-time talk radio during the changing backdrop of America's pre- and post-9/11 realities. This exciting story includes Bernadette's impressions of the quirky celebrity talk show hosts whom she served during her career: Larry King, Sally Jesse Raphael, Gil Gross, Tom Snyder, Lou Dobbs, Charles Osgood, and more. It's full of anecdotes about hundreds of high-profile guests from media, show business, and politics, also quirky, ego-driven, and neurotic. Yappy Days, Behind the Scenes with Newsers, Schmoozers, Boozers, and Losers, an analytical look at the media, journalism, and the complex nature of ego. Get it now at Amazon.com. Continuing now with the Michael Harrison Wrap. There are lots of views being expressed in the American talk media about the Russian invasion of Ukraine. We're joined now by WABC New York overnight host Frank Morano, who bravely interviewed an American communist expat living in the Ukrainian breakaway Republic of Donetsk, where he's been fighting on behalf of the Russians for the past 8 years. How did that come about, and what's your position on handling this major story that has just plummeted on the table for talk show hosts, and that is the Russia-Ukraine crisis?
I appreciate you mentioning this. I'm really proud of this, I have to say, and more so than pride. I'm hoping that what we did here serves as an inspiration to other talk show hosts all over the country. So, the biggest story right now in the whole world, the thing that every cable news channel, every newspaper is focused on, is what's happening in eastern Ukraine, namely this decision by Vladimir Putin, the Russian president, to recognize these two breakaway republics, which he and Venezuela and other countries, I learned in the course of doing this interview, have now also recognized as independent countries. So a few years ago, maybe about 6, 7, or 8 years ago, I came across an article in some obscure publication from Texas with the headline, "Meet the Texas Communist Who's Trolling for Putin." And I found so many different things interesting about this. One, you know, Putin is, for all his faults, he is a virulent anti-communist. So why would a communist be going on social media advocating on his behalf? And why would any American move out of Texas, out of the United States, to eastern Ukraine? And if you do that, why would you be fighting against the Ukrainian government along with these ethnic Russian separatists? So about 7 or 8 years ago, I met this fellow, Russell Bentley, telephonically, and we had a very good phone conversation. So once this fighting started breaking out, and once this became a new global hotspot, I said let me try and reach out to him again and see if he is able to be in touch. He said, look, as long as they don't cut off the electricity, as long as we're not being shelled by mortar fire, I'm happy to talk with you. And he did. And I asked a very candid conversation, and there were a lot of people that were unhappy with me for giving a platform to Russian propaganda, or people that were unhappy with me for giving a platform to a communist. My view was, this is the biggest story in the world right now, and it at least behooves us to hear the point of view of someone in Donetsk that wants to be recognized by Putin. So I think this is what talk radio is all about. And I think that when it comes to the motivation of why you do a story like this, what I've tried to do on the other side of midnight is always find an angle to the popular stories that nobody else is doing. And I think this certainly fits that that description.
What is your feeling about what he said? Is there a Russian point of view that is valid to at least one degree or another in terms of this story?
You know, I've covered a lot of trials over the years, and a lot of times when an attorney is cross-examining a witness, or even on direct examination, they'll ask a question, and the judge sort of cautions them, and the lawyer will say to the court, he'll say, "All right, I'm offering the witness's response not for the truth of its content, but for the fact that it was said," meaning the fact that something was said had a motivating factor in whatever the next step was. And that's how I sort of view this, right? So I tried to challenge Russell Bentley on several of his assertions.
You did.
He's alleging that the people that are fighting the Ukrainian separatists alongside the Ukrainian government are not just backed by America, but are neo-Nazis and ISIS. Now, that's a pretty bold claim, and I have no way of verifying if that's true. And I tried to press him for evidence and for other things. But my view is, this is why I'm very sympathetic to Joe Rogan and the free speech advocates as part of the whole Spotify debate, is we shouldn't hesitate to offer all platforms a point of view. And if you're part of the biggest story, I think it's important to at least understand what the other point of view is. In this case, Russell Bentley represents not just the Russian point of view, but the point of view of people that live in Donetsk and eastern in the Donbas region in Ukraine. So I'm happy to have on other people to rebut what he's saying, and callers called in almost immediately rebutting what he was saying. But I think if we have the same sort of cable news mentality of repeating right-wing and left-wing talking points, I don't think that does much to further the conversation, and I don't think it does much to further my audience's understanding of a given political issue, which is quite complicated.
Did you get any negative blowback from management at WABC?
You know, I have to tell you, and I'm not just saying this because he listens to you as well, but John Catsimatidis is the fiercest free speech advocate I've ever known. And as you could tell, but with a lot of the folks that are on our station who, you know, have had sort of a controversial and colorful history themselves, he does not cower away from controversy at all. In fact, some of the more controversial interviews that I've done, he's actually asked to replay on his own program and have me on to explain why I wanted to do them. So, no, I have gotten, the God's honest truth, no blowback from having an American expatriate, a communist, in the most controversial area of the world right now. I've had no blowback whatsoever, and it makes me appreciate even more why I'm blessed to work for a radio station that values free speech so much.
Now, one of the interesting things about this whole thing is that there is intellectually, if you open your mind, and I'm not endorsing this, I'm just simply saying in the spirit of what you're talking about, there is a Russian point of view that has to be taken into consideration and fully understanding, as you pointed out, the complexity of this situation. And you're not alone in talk radio in giving it a platform. Now, you gave it a platform and provided some pushback. There are many talk show hosts who actually are saying that Russia's point of view is valid and that we don't have it right. So I'm just pointing that out to you. What's your response to that?
Well, no, I certainly agree. And look, you see certain people, not just in the talk radio sphere, but in the media in general, certain people on the right that have been willing to put out a more nuanced point of view. I'm thinking of people like Pat Buchanan, Rand Paul, Tucker Carlson, and then certain people on the left, same thing. I'm thinking of people like Tulsi Gabbard, Glenn Greenwald, and Katrina VandenHeuvel from The Nation. And, you know, I don't think people need to agree with that, but I think it is important for people to understand that. I mean, if we're talking about a very realistic possibility of either armed conflict or sanctions or cyber warfare with the second largest nuclear power on the face of the earth, I think we had better understand exactly why that side is doing what they, at least what they say, doing what they're doing. And we can agree with it, we can disagree with it, we can use it to help form our own opinions or craft American foreign policy, but we should at least understand where they're coming from, and that's sort of what I've tried to do here. And again, I've had people that have had precisely the opposite point of view, folks like General Wesley Clark and others. And look, you know, when you're on in a city like New York, the diversity of opinions that come up every time you open the phone line. So it's not as if we're trying to be a mouthpiece for the Russian government at all. We're happy to showcase all points of view, including the ones that you don't hear throughout most of conventional mainstream media.
You said that Vladimir Putin is a virulent anti-communist. What does that mean?
Well, look, the leading opposition party to Vladimir Putin's party in Russia is the Communist Party. They run a candidate against him every year, and that's usually the candidate that performs best. If you look at sort of the domestic politics of Russia, there are some people in Russia that don't think Putin goes far enough to the right. And then there are the communists that want to, you know, relive the glory days of the Soviet Union. Putin, for all his faults, he may be a dictator. He may not value things like human rights and freedom of the press and the right to protest freely. But he might be an oligarch. He might be in the pocket of various other oligarchs. But he is the furthest thing from a communist. If you look at his entire political career, since the Iron Curtain has fallen, whereas other people have tried to, you know, embrace the idea of communism.
That's WABC New York talk show host Frank Morano. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison rap. With all the talk going on about Russia and Ukraine, let's not forget that we're still mired in the COVID era. Let's check in now with one of radio's most respected physicians, Dr. Dahlia Wax of the Genesis Communications Network. Well, Dr. Wax, it seems that the war in between Russia and the Ukraine has pushed COVID-19 down a bit on the talkers chart, so we're getting a bit of a relief from it in terms of conversation this week, but that doesn't mean it's gone away, does it?
No, it doesn't. You know, we are still sadly, you know, battling a lot of hospitalizations. It is going down, thank heavens, but there has been some news that the variant, the stealth variant or the son of Omicron or baby Omicron subvariant is starting to make its way across the United States. We're a little concerned about this one because of its infectivity and because of its ability to escape current immune and vaccine protocols. But it's not currently on the radar with everything else going on, which is obviously so tragic and devastating.
What do you know about this new subvariant?
Well, what we do know is the subvariant is supposed to be more infectious. It does have a higher affinity to the nasal epithelial cells than the previous Omicron, its father Omicron, and that it can escape immunity. In fact, there has been some discussion with some other, you know, researchers globally that the vaccines might not work for the subvariant. And as you and I have discussed, the vaccines have given some great baseline protection against hospitalization and death. It just, they need to be updated for the mutations, the spike mutations within the spike proteins. And so I think it will follow a predictable pattern. But what I tell everybody when it comes to subvariants is there was Delta Plus for a little while, the subvariant of Delta, and that never overtook Delta. So just because there's a subvariant of a very predominant strain, it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to get its day in the sun like its predecessor did.
Well, you and I have both discussed the fact that we lean away from the idea of mandates. And it does seem that the mandates are coming down and people just tend to either be a little bit more loose about social distancing and masking and things of that nature. Is that going to be a danger? Should people suddenly become, more, protect themselves a little more than they may be doing because of this?
You know, it's interesting. If everybody had access to the N95 masks, you know, I would have a much different answer. But what the average person has been using has not provided enough of a barrier or enough protection, which is why when people got Omicron, they were frustrated. Like me, myself, I'm wearing my mask. I'm vaccinated. Why did I get Omicron? And so I think because we have to look at the long game, and the long game is going to be what's happening with Russia. Are we going to be dealing with, bioweapons? Are we going to be dealing with gas? And if, trust me, if we need to wear a gas mask, that's when you want the public listening, saying, yes, sir. And, what do you want us to do? And I think the masks mandates over the past year and a half to almost 2 years has been managed so poorly that I am scared to death that something serious is going to happen as a result of this war or China getting involved. And then when we ask the American public, all right, guys, we're going to need you to mask up or do certain things for your protection, they're going to be like, oh, heck no, we've been through that for 2 years. So I think the mask relaxation guidelines isn't really N95 masks. They're the face coverings that don't seem to be working much. So I'm not as worried. And there might be a benefit in the long run because people will get over that fatigue they've had with mandates and hopefully be ready for new guidance if, God forbid, we need it.
I'm hearing more and more people say that they are hearing news that the vaccines themselves are dangerous and that the boosters are dangerous. Is there anything new on that front, or is this just, the to be expected downside of any vaccine suddenly being hyped up politically?
Yeah, you bring up a really good point, Michael, because, we haven't in the news covered all the MMR side effects or the tetanus or polio vaccine side effects. But when a child gets myocarditis, or we had in our city an 18-year-old get a blood clot, that makes the news. And so, the CDC is expanding its guidance now for young men to expand the interval between the vaccines because of the myocarditis risks. And so, danger is as danger does. So if people get myocarditis, they're going to be scared to death of the vaccine. For those of us that are scared, that we're fine, got our vaccines without any issues and are fearing COVID is more dangerous. So I stand by what I've always said. The risk of COVID is more dangerous than the risk of the vaccines, but the vaccines do carry risks. And the CDC does have on their website death rates of it, myocarditis. In fact, the MISC, the multi-system inflammatory syndrome that can come with COVID, they have found in vaccinated individuals who never had COVID. So there are risks. Absolutely. But yeah, I think you're right. We might be just, talking about every single bad thing that happens when it is induced by a vaccine, that we don't realize that it might be in kind of the normal range of side effects with vaccines. It's just we've also never tried to vaccinate a whole country. So the numbers are going to be higher.
That's noted physician and radio talk show host Dr. Dahlia Wax of the Genesis Communications Network. Coming up next, a visit to Denver, Colorado, and a conversation with outstanding talk show host Ross Kaminsky. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap.
This report is brought to you by Genesis 2 Project, G2P. Recently, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, the ODNI, released a preliminary report on possible threats posed by UFOs, now known as Unidentified Aerial Phenomena, UAP, and the progress the Department of Defense UAP Task Force has made in understanding any threats. Dr. J.C. Van Valkenburg is a former Los Alamos National Lab biophysicist who has been working with G2P to bring scientifically sound UAP data to the public.
G2P has released the first scientifically authenticated documentation of UAPs, including images captured with infrared technology. Primo Forensics performed the digital forensic analysis.
In tandem with the ODNI report, these data support the development of relevant processes, policies, technologies, and training for the U.S. military and government personnel upon encountering UAP. Visit Genesis2Project.com.
Continuing now with the Michael Harrison Wrap, as we discuss the hottest topics of the past week in the national conversation. My guest this week on my podcast, The Michael Harrison Interview, is Ross Kaminsky of KOA Radio in Denver, the sister station of our affiliate in the Mile High City, Freedom 93.7 KDFD. Ross is one of talk radio's leading experts on foreign policy and the economy. The following conversation was excerpted from that podcast.
In college, my major was political science, but it was really foreign policy. So I studied Soviet politics, I studied Chinese communist politics, I studied nuclear strategy and national security and things like that. So I'm very fascinated by it. And I've got to say, Vladimir Putin is as hard a person to read as I've ever seen on the international stage. And maybe some of that comes from all of his years of training as a KGB spy. I think that we're in a very difficult situation for the United States perspective, because I don't think we have a significant strategic interest in protecting Ukraine, and they're not a treaty ally where we are bound to protect them. And on the other hand, we don't want to show Russia and we don't want to show China that we will let them just take over territory. I'm especially concerned about what China will do with this lesson. But it's not easy for me to say this, but I think the Biden administration is mostly handling it right.
You know, you mentioned China and Taiwan, where we seem to be in the age of rising authoritarianism around the world. Don't think that Xi Jinping isn't watching what's going on in Russia and saying, this is our chance to take over Taiwan. And I want to cover two quick areas while I have you. One is one of your fortes, as mentioned, and in my introduction to this program, I talk about your background in the markets and in economics, and in Chicago, you're a trader. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts about the economy at the moment?
Wow, I'm very concerned about. I can imagine stagflation. And I am just old enough to kind of remember what that feels like, or what it felt like to have my parents reacting to it in the late 1970s, where you had prices going up, but unemployment going up at the same time. And this thing that was called the misery index, right? The combination of unemployment and inflation.
I remember it well.
Right now, to me, the misery index feels like inflation plus crime rate in this country.
Wow.
And I'm quite nervous about it. I also think that this administration, almost any economic idea they put forward is a bad idea. They just believe things that are really wrong and have been proven wrong repeatedly in history when it comes to basic economics. And I'm concerned, but bigger, separate from the administration, the Fed and Treasury combined, they have put so much new money into the economy. And all these people are talking about, well, the supply chain will get better and inflation will come down, or, you know, we'll cut the gas tax and that people will feel better. And it's not how inflation works. Inflation is about new money chasing goods. And you can slightly increase the supply of goods if the supply chain gets better. But until that new money, all this nonsense that happened under Trump and Biden, I'm not pointing the finger at just one. They were both guilty. I think inflation is going to stay with us for longer than people think. It's going to be very painful, and it is going to be by far the biggest issue in the November 2022 elections.
And what do you think about this big quit? I know that ties into the supply chain issue and the availability of goods and services, but it's not the whole thing. There's a psychological component to this. And we spoke earlier about people working from home, both in radio and in terms of general life. A lot of people just don't want to go back to work, or they don't want to go back to the office. Some people don't want to work at all. Some people, they're going through life crisis or some type of revelation or whatever, and they other things are more important to them now after this experience of being, you know, isolated and being home and quarantined and reevaluating their priorities. Other people want to work. They just don't want to go back to the office. They're able to do quite well. What are your thoughts about the big quit?
So I would broadly break the big quit or the great resignation into two groups of people. One is people who just retired and they're never going to work again. And the other is people who are young enough or not rich enough that they need to keep working. The people who retired early, and there are a huge number of them, like, you know, baby boomers who thought they were 2-3 years away from retirement, and they saw the value of their homes go up a lot and the value of their 401ks go up a lot. And they said, you know what, between the fact that I'm more financially secure than I thought I would be now, and the fact that if I go to work and I'm a little older, I might be at excess risk for COVID, I'm going to quit. And it's fine for them as long as the value of their house stays up and the value of their 401ks stay up. And, you know, for everybody's sake, I hope they do. But if those things do tank, and you could imagine at least some impingement on those values with the rising interest rates we're looking at right now, you know, people who were right on the margin of that being a good idea or not, they're going to have some trouble. And what I worry about for them is how difficult it is for someone who's been out of the workforce for a while to get a job. And then you just, it's exponentially more difficult if you're 60 and you've been out of the workforce for a while and need to get a job. So that's that side. On the other side, you know, younger people, I actually think that in the long run, this is going to be an insanely positive thing for the economy and for all those people. And, you know, as a libertarian, I care about individual flourishing more than I care about anything you want to ask me about regarding society as a whole. And for all these people who have quit, one of the things we've noticed is huge numbers of new businesses being started. People saying, I don't want to, you know, go to the office, or I didn't love that thing. I'm going to do my own thing. And maybe my own thing is competing with my old business, but maybe it's something completely different. And when you get more people doing things that they love and that I assume they're probably a little better at than they were at the thing they didn't love, in the long run, I have to think it's an enormous positive.
That's Ross Kaminsky, talk show host at KOA Radio, the sister station of our affiliate in Denver, Freedom 93.7 KDFD. The conversation you just heard was excerpted from this week's installment of my podcast, The Michael Harrison Interview. To hear the entire podcast, please visit mhinterview.com. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. We have time for one more. The dynamic subjects of big tech and social media have become staples in the national conversation, with topics ranging from invasion of privacy to political censorship. Former President Donald Trump is now in the social media platform business with the soft launch of his new app, Truth Social, looking to compete directly with Twitter, the mega platform that banned him from using it to reach his gazillion followers. We're joined now by the producer of this program, as well as the associate publisher of Talkers Magazine. He's an attorney and a professor who teaches media law at Western New England University School of Law. He's also my son, Matthew B. Harrison. Okay, Matthew, set it up for us. Trump has his new social media platform out there. It's obviously to give him a platform to compete against and to replace, in his case, Twitter. And what's the story?
So this is the flagship app of his new social media company. And he hopes to create this platform that can thrive without the constraints imposed by what he's called big tech. What shouldn't come as a surprise, though, is that there are at least seven other social media companies that have promised to do the same exact thing, all of which have more time getting ready than he has getting his product ready. Getter has approximately 5 million users, Parler 15 million users. Both are Twitter-esque. Twitter has 211 million users. MeWe, which boasts 20 million users, and CloutHub has about 4 million users, are both similar to Facebook, which has 1.9 billion users. And Rumble, which has 39 million users, is similar to YouTube, which has over 2 billion active users.
Wow, this is really gigantic tech when you think about it. It has to be enormously complicated to run those type of, you know, algorithms and systems. I can't even begin to imagine how these platforms are organized. You got to give Trump a lot of credit for an ambitious project. I understand that it's off and running mixed reviews as to the launch, that it is running, but that I guess, I don't know how to interpret it, more people want to use it than they're able to handle, so they've created a waiting list. What's the word in the technical community about how it's done this first week?
So the site launched into what they are referring to as beta mode, which is basically saying, we know that it's not perfect, but if you help us and you report all the errors, we can make it better. And a lot of software companies have open beta periods so that their users can experience the product and provide, you know, insightful feedback to make it better. This beta should have been limited, but it was open and it was first come, first serve. And the waiting list grew to at least 500,000 people. But at last check, Donald Trump's real Donald Trump username only had 50,000 followers as opposed to his 89 million Twitter followers.
I wonder what that could be attributed to. Maybe people don't know about it because, you know, the fact, as we said, it's quietly being rolled out in a beta stage. Maybe they need to promote it more, or maybe they're better off not. Maybe he should let it not have that many people listening or listening, people tuned in and using it and posting and reading until it's right. Is there anything that Trump can do to, you know, help the thing along? Are there any tricks in the trade?
Yeah. He can be like some of the other websites, Getter, Parler, and Rumble, who have relied on Twitter to announce the signing of new right-wing personalities or influencers. Parler specifically used Twitter to post an announcement that Melania Trump, the former first lady, was making its platform her social media home. Not sure if that still applies.
Do you think that he is specifically not doing... Well, he can't do it, can he? Because he's banned.
Yes, he specifically cannot do it, but that doesn't mean that he can't encourage as many fans to do it on his behalf.
I was thinking about when you were mentioning all of those platforms. I know Parler was a response to what's considered to be bias against conservatives on some of these platforms. Facebook faces that as well. Are most of these... you know, platforms that are designed to compete with Twitter, such as Parler and Getter. There's a political component to all of them, isn't there, to bypass what seems to be a liberal bias in Silicon Valley. Is that accurate?
Yes, and there does seem to be a marketplace for this type of social media. But surprisingly, a majority of people do not want a version of the internet where anything goes. Additionally, there's also a specter of impropriety with this launch. Regulators are currently investigating whether Digital World, which is the partner in this merger and the creation of this social media company, whether they flouted security regulations when they planned this merger with Trump Media. So it's not clear exactly how this deal came about, and it's currently under investigation.
Another thing for Trump to deal with in terms of investigation. But, you know, there's a paradox, a conundrum to this whole thing of, okay, Silicon Valley, okay, Twitter, okay, Facebook, you're censoring us based upon what you call misinformation. In many cases, you call it misinformation. We call it something that is a different point of view than you want to be the narrative, you know, bias and censorship. And so we're going to put on a platform that is truthful. We're going to put on a platform that doesn't have that type of bias or censorship and that is not afraid to present the conservative point of view in this case. But the downside to that is people can come on and do whatever they want, which means they can put misinformation in or they can present a liberal point of view and actually have a lot of negative blowback and troll you. Is there the danger of that happening?
There certainly may be some users out there who are going to take advantage of the fact that they can wait in line and get on this platform and then say whatever they want, which is going to run counter to, you know, the majority of the site. There's not a lot of marketplace interest for a website like that. Rumble, which has 31 million users, earned last year $7 million. YouTube, over 2 billion active users, made $9 billion. So we're talking about new kids on the block trying to be the alternative to the big machine. But the big machine has been in place a long time and has been making a lot of money.
That's the producer of this show, the associate publisher of Talkers, an attorney and a law professor at Western New England University School of Law, Matthew B. Harrison. And that about does it for this latest installment of the Michael Harrison Wrap, an overview of the national conversation, looking back at the week of Monday, February 21st through Friday, February 25th, 2022. Looking ahead, I'm sure we'll have plenty to talk about next week, including the ever-lurking unknown factor, that unanticipated surprise story that can take the national conversation spinning off in a totally unexpected direction. We sure do live in interesting times. I can be reached via email at michael@talkers.com. My podcast, The Michael Harrison Interview, can be heard at mhinterview.com. And if you want to stay in touch with the inner workings of the talk media industry, please visit talkers.com. The Michael Harrison Wrap. Our producer is Matthew B. Harrison. Thank you for listening.
The Michael Harrison Wrap is a production of Good Phone Communications, presented in association with Talk Media Network and Talkers Magazine. Copyright 2022, all rights reserved.